The perils of ignoring reality. Geography has not been taught as a subject in public schools here or on the other side of the Atlantic for decades. Same is true of history, geography's companion discipline. The two subjects are now loosely lumped together under the heading social studies. If social studies were simply a harmonisation and rationalisation of two closely related subjects, that would be one thing. Unnecessary, perhaps, excessive, probably, but essentially benevolent in its intent. When one examines its fruits, however, one can see the results have been anything but laudable. Today, a majority of American children have only the haziest picture of the geography of the country in which they live, and an even sketchier idea of its history. As to world geography, forget about it. This has serious implications for the future of our democracy. Not least, an electorate which cannot locate Puerto Rico, still less at San Jose and Ponce, on a map, can scarcely be expected to pass an informed judgment on claims that the federal government's response to the recent hurricane was woefully inadequate. Nor is an electorate so wholly ignorant of world geography, geology, and geopolitics equipped to assess the historical, political, economic, and military implications for the US in crises in such faraway places as North Korea, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, the Yemen, and Afghanistan. In short, our abandonment of the serious study of geography in our public schools leaves America prey to demagogues, deceivers, and fanatics of every stripe. And the same goes for the polarization of our history. More than 30 years have passed since one of my daughters asked, "Mommy, what did men do during the revolution?" Her social studies textbooks dealt extensively with how it affected women, Native Americans, and slaves. But the role of the founding fathers and the fighting men were treated so casually as to virtually ignore them. Things have not improved in the interim. The problem is that social studies, as a subject, was conceived neither to teach history nor to inform us about the world in which we live. Its primary purpose seems to be social engineering, to impart proper attitudes and to foster appropriate behaviour. In short, it is history and geography bent to the purpose of social engineers. Why, for example, teach children to locate the continents or the world's capitals when learning how far flung places are tends to undermine the goal of teaching them to think globally? The same goes for history. Similarly, our self-anointed Solons have expurgated religion from Western history, precisely on the grounds that religion is divisive and gets in the way of our sex lives or some other such nonsense. A typically egregious example occurred a decade ago at an exhibition on William Shakespeare at the National Portrait Gallery in London, England. Because there are so few authentic portraits of the bard, the curators who staged the exhibition assembled all manner of artifacts he would have encountered or employed during the course of his daily life and work. In addition to artworks, there were clothes, weapons, tools, household utensils, literature, and manuscripts in the hand of contemporary playwrights. But three things that exerted an overwhelming influence on Shakespeare's life and work were notable solely by their absence. They were the Book of Common Prayer of 1558, Miles Coverdale's Great Bible, and the Geneva Bible. Shakespeare was so intimate with the prayer book, he plundered it continually for felicitous expressions and figures of speech. Much the same is true of the two great translations of the Bible. In other words, the role of theology, the hot-button issue of his age, were entirely ignored in the exploration of the psyche of a major public figure whose life was dominated by issues of religion. I suppose this is only to be expected of people who applaud the notion of excising the role of the church from the political, social, intellectual, and spiritual history of the Middle Ages. However, while one might not like religion or the religiously minded any more than one likes leprosy, syphilis, and the Black Death, all five played a major role in shaping the foundations upon which our history is laid. and discussion of them should not be suppressed simply because they are distasteful. Moreover, if we fail to understand the past, it is unlikely we shall understand the present, and this bodes evil, at least for that which is to come. As it happens, a worrisome failure to understand the past is currently threatening our future. Our political leaders tell us Islam is fundamentally a religion of peace, and Islamic resentment against the West is largely fueled by the devastation inflicted on the Muslim world by the Crusades. What they don't tell us, however, is that the Crusades were the West's much belated response to more than 400 years of savage jihad that destroyed countless thriving Christian communities in North Africa and the Middle East, and had subjected all Portugal, Spain and Sicily, and much of France and Italy, to brutal Muslim rule. Nor do they explain that terrorism, kidnapping and enslavement have been tools of Islam from its very inception, but that the United States has been a victim of jihadist oppression from the very moment of its independence. In 1793, for example, 11 American ships were seized by Barbary pirates, Muslim terrorists operating out of Algiers and Tripoli, who kidnapped, enslaved and held to ransom millions, literally millions, of innocent Christian men, women and children. Unable to raise the funds to pay the ransom for the crews, the US representative was compelled to borrow from a friendly Jewish money lender living in Algiers to pay nearly $1 million in ransom. But it only served to encourage terrorism. Well into the first third of the 19th century, two-thirds of the US federal budget went to paying off the maritime terrorists whose direct descendants today slaughter innocents on a worldwide scale. Such knowledge might not encourage people to support current counter-terrorist policies, but absent such an historical perspective, how can they form a worthwhile opinion one way or the other?